ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When Deborah Richardson was 18 years old, she was living with her parents in the suburbs of Melbourne and working at a call centre job that she absolutely hated. She thought about the kind of work that her older brother got to do as a police officer and decided to give that a crack. By the following year, Deborah was accepted into the Victorian Police Academy and graduated in 1984 as one of only a handful of female officers. One day, Deborah was at work at the Russell Street Police Station in Melbourne CBD when a car bomb exploded outside. And although she was lucky to avoid serious injury, the experience deeply affected her. Years later, Deborah and her husband took the child of another police officer into their home. The boy's name was Yuri. He was from Ukraine. His family were survivors of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Back home in Kyiv, Yuri grew up to become a police officer himself. And it was a project that Deb set up to support Yuri after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which ended up helping Deb in a way she could never have anticipated. Hi, Deborah.
Hello, Sarah.
You signed up for Victoria Police when you were just 18. What was life like at the academy?
It was tough, if I'm frank. I really struggled through school and you know, I was actually reflecting over the last few days and looking back at my final report in year 11, and it said that I completed art, English and typing, which was really actually a fail, but passing three out of my six subjects. And so life was a struggle for me. I hated school, didn't want to work there, and my mum was convinced that I needed to go and work in the bank. And, of course, I'd failed maths, so I was never going to get a bank job, although she made me apply for a couple. And so I ended up in this call centre at the Gas and Fuel Corporation with about 200 other women sitting in a call centre, taking phone calls and complaints all day long, and then thought, no, I need to do something better with my life. So I applied. It was a time where there was so many men in the environment and only 2% of women, as you've said, Sarah. And so it was difficult. The academy was a hard life for me. I had to learn how to study, and certainly the physical aspect. You had to learn to run and jump and swim and all of those things on top of study.
And how did the sergeants in charge of training speak to new recruits like you?
Particularly the women, we got a very hard time. and in fact, they would often use, and I'm going to use the word lightly, intimidation, if you like. I guess they wanted to make sure that we could handle things once we got out on the road. And so to yell and scream at you and point at you and all of those things were not unusual.
And how did you handle that? I mean, was that something you were familiar with, had experienced in your life before?
No, absolutely not. It was very new to me. And, you know, I guess as a young 18-year-old, your first reaction is you want to burst into tears. But then I think your next reaction is, actually, I've got to prove to them I can handle this. And so it gives you a little bit of a steely resolve.
You had to take part in something called Alcohol Awareness Day. What did that involve? It's not something I think would fly with HR departments now.
I don't think it would be part of the curriculum at the Police Academy anymore. What they were wanting to do was to demonstrate how alcohol affected different people, different sexes, different sizes of people. And so the sergeant in charge had told us that we were having an alcohol awareness day, and he said half of you will be the drinkers and half of you will be the observers. And then he looked at me and he said, Deborah, I'm nominating you to be a drinker. Now, at 18, I'd barely had a glass of wine, Sarah.
And why do you think he pinpointed you?
Well, I was the youngest and I was female, and in those days I was also very tiny, so I think it was going to be evident that I would be quickly affected by the alcohol.
And were you? As you say, you hadn't drunk much before.
100%. I was completely and utterly drunk and went through every emotion that you can possibly imagine on the day. So one minute I was crying, I'd just broken up with a boyfriend. The next minute I was laughing hysterically. And throughout the course of the day, they put you through a series of tests. So walk a straight line, try and catch this ruler. Yes, incredibly drunk. I was asked to drink 8 glasses of wine in the first hour and to keep drinking after that.
Oh, my gosh. So you made it through this day. I imagine woke up the next day feeling pretty horrible.
But absolutely.
Then what happened a few days later?
A few days later, I was sitting in a class and a sergeant came in and I was told that I needed to go to the superintendent's office. And we only had about 4 weeks left in the academy. And so very unusual that you were being called to the superintendent's office. And when I arrived, one of the other policewomen that was in my squad had walked out of that room. And I looked at her and I said, are you okay? And she gave me the thumbs down and she said, see you later, I'm gone. And I was like, oh my goodness, what is going on? And so I walked into the room and there was about 12 various degrees from sergeant up to the superintendent sitting around in a semicircle with one chair in the middle of that was for me. And I sat down and during the course of the Alcohol Awareness Day, they had filmed us. And so they had video evidence of what had gone on for the day.
Did you know that?
I can't say that I recall that we were even told that that was going to happen, possibly, but again, I was drunk. So my awareness of that, I'm not sure. And all of a sudden, the sergeant opens up and he said, we've called you in here today because we believe you have an emotional disturbance and you shouldn't be a policewoman.
And
we
want to know. From viewing that footage of you.
From viewing the footage.
After being forced to drink all of this
exactly.
alcohol.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so I think it was also on the back of this particular sergeant on day two of me being out at the academy, Sarah, was yelling and screaming in my face, pointing at me, telling me I was too young, I was too pretty, I was female and I wouldn't last, and he would do everything in his power to make sure that I didn't. And so this was the same sergeant that had filmed me and obviously put in the complaint. And I was fired all these questions, particularly along the lines of, you know, what are you going to do when you get called to a brawl? I'm assuming that you're going to sit in the van and you're going to lock those doors and not get out to support your police officer beside you. And so left, right and centre, these questions were coming at me.
How did you respond to all of this?
I fought really hard. I kept my dignity. I kept my calm. You know, I was like a swan, smooth on the top and frantically paddling underneath the water because this was what I wanted to do and I was not going to let them win. And I knew I had something to offer and that I could do the job and I could do it capably. And so I fought really hard.
And it succeeded? I mean, you succeeded in that?
I did. So I left the room not knowing what the outcome of that was, although I kind of thought, well, I must have done okay because the lady who'd gone in before me was packing up and already out of the academy doors. So I knew in some regards that whatever I had said meant that they needed to deliberate on that. And I think it was the next day that I was informed that I could stay. The day I graduated, my law instructor came up to me that evening. We had a dinner and he said to me, Deb, I'm so proud of you. He said, we had made the decision before you walked in those doors that you were no longer going to be a member of Victoria Police. And the decision had been made. And he goes, if you hadn't fought as hard as you did, you would have been gone. And I'm so proud of you.
Given that the police force was something you kind of fell into after seeing your brother in the job, were you almost surprised by your determination to stick it out in that kind of environment?
Yeah, I guess I was. Although at the same time, once the decision had been made, the thing that attracted me to the job was, you know, there was over kind of 300 different areas you could go and work in if you didn't like something. Like, what other job gives you that opportunity? And so I'm not sure. I guess it was a level of maturity that came on me very quickly.
What kind of bonds did you form with the other recruits over that period of your training?
We were family. There was absolutely no doubt about it. We had, I smile now when I look at the age that I'm at, but we had an older man and an older female that we called mum and dad of the squad.
Like I think in their 30s.
I think they might have been early 40s, but
ancient.
You know, yeah, very ancient. But we absolutely became a family. And I still say to this day, I really miss the job. There is no other organisation or career where you truly do form that brotherhood and sisterhood. And whether or not you like the person, you know that you would give your life for them, you know, should that be required. And the bond is incredibly special.
Where was your first posting as a police officer?
So we were allowed to put in some preferences, and I didn't get any of my preferences. And I ended out in the eastern suburbs, a little town called Croydon, which was very much a sleepy hollow. There was, virtually nothing ever happened at this station, and that was my first station.
That's great for Croydon, but maybe not so interesting for a new police officer.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, you then had a very different experience in a stint with the Vice Squad, where you were assigned to undercover work. What did that involve?
I went in, much to my mum's horror, when she realised it a couple of weeks down the track, I went in to play prostitute and very much part of the Vice Squad. So,
well, I guess as you were saying, there weren't many female police officers at that time. So I guess from their point of view, having a young woman officer, there's huge scope for undercover work.
There was, and we didn't look like a policewoman. You know, when I took the uniform off and took my hair out was, long, halfway down my back, and I didn't look like a typical policewoman, if you can define one that.
And so what was a typical day undercover like for you?
So initially I was standing on the streets of St Kilda. We were looking for people that were, I think the terrible nickname in those days was gutter crawlers, and we were looking for the men that were trying to entice a female. And so initially I was doing street work.
And would you make an arrest immediately that happened, or how did it play out?
So we had to obviously wait for someone to approach us. I couldn't say anything to them, so they would have to offer me money for sex. And so it was, sometimes the conversation would dance around a little bit because I wasn't allowed to say anything or lead them to say what they wanted. And then eventually, once they had admitted that that's what they were wanting, then I would pull out my police badge, and very quickly, in most instances, my colleagues would then come up to support me with that arrest.
What was your experience of that, Deborah? Of
pretending
to be
strange.
Yes.
Very strange. I also a number of times would stand on the corner thinking, God, I hope no one I know drives past me, because I was like, I don't want them to think I'm doing something that I'm not really doing. So it was a very strange scenario to be in as a very young woman.
Were you good at that undercover work, at taking risks and pretending to be another person?
I was. And so I graduated from the streets of St Kilda very quickly into the massage parlours. And very quickly after the massage parlours, I went into the escort agencies, which were really where the true crime was happening.
How would that play out?
So I applied for all of the jobs. I got every job that I applied for. Then I would leave, and then we would come back and effect the arrest.
What sort of risks were there for you physically in your safety?
Well, Sarah, I think, I was wearing a wire, so you've always got to be conscious of someone sitting in the car listening, thank goodness, but you are conscious of that wire, and you need to make sure that people aren't aware that you've got anything on you. I used to carry a little handbag with my little 5-shot Smith & Wesson gun in it, and again, you would just have to be aware. But I created a persona, and I look back at that time, and I had my own undercover story that I knew if I was asked enough questions that I could give sufficient answers. And I played a role.
What happened to end your time with the Vice Squad, Deb?
I had a situation, Sarah, where I came into work one day, and how we would decide to target these places. Sometimes we would literally look in the Yellow Pages or the Truth newspaper in those days for people that were advertising, and then I would normally just sit in the squad room and make a phone call and apply for a job, and typically they'd just say, yeah, when can you come in? And I would organise a time, and then we would go and have the interview. And this particular day I came in, and it was quite frantic around the squad room, and all of a sudden the inspector grabbed me and he said, oh, Deb, I want you to call this particular organisation today. And I said, okay, boss. And so I went out to sit in the squad room to make the call. And he goes, no, I want you to make the call in my office. And that was unusual. And so I made the call and he shut the door and I'm thinking, okay, this is a little bit weird. And he was standing outside the door and it was the first time I'd been asked so many questions on the phone and like really detailed questions, like what were my measurements? How many men had I slept with? What did I like doing or not doing? And I eventually got off the phone after about 15 or 20 minutes and I had organised to meet them at a 7-Eleven shop, which was also very strange. And as soon as I opened the door, the inspector said, have we got them? Are we on? And I went, yeah, 3 o'clock today, boss at blah, 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 7-Eleven. And so he's kind of walked out into the squad room and gone, it's on. And then there was this hive of activity with the guys running around. I can see them getting out ballistic vests, grabbing the shotguns. And I looked at him and I said, is this all for me? And he goes, yeah, you'll be fine. And I've gone, no, like what's going on? Because this hadn't happened before. And he said, okay, I better explain to you. And he took me back into his office and he passed a statement over to me on the desk and he said, have a read of that. And it was from an informer, a young female similarly to me, had phoned for a job interview. She'd met them at a 7-Eleven shop where she was blindfolded. She had a gun held to her head, driven to a remote location, and in her words, she was bench tested for the job. And then she got the job, and within a matter of weeks, they found out who her boyfriend was, and he was beaten up to an inch of his life. She saw them running drugs. She saw a murder happen, all of these horrific things. And I looked at him and I said, I don't think I can do this, boss. And he goes, of course you can. You've been amazing. You've done it all. We've been after these guys for such a long time. You'll be fine. And I said, can I wear a wire? And he goes, no, you can't wear a wire for this case. And I'm like, so how will I know that you're behind me? And he goes, Deb, we're the best at the job. Of course we'll be behind you. And I was really struggling in that moment going, what am I going to do? Is my career going to be over because I'm going to say no? And I just couldn't do it, Sarah. I was sitting there going, in all the doubts flooded into my brain that I am not an actress and this is not my life and I can't do this. It was all these negative thoughts going through my head. And I said to him, boss, I can't do it. And so he walked out to the squad room and he goes, it's off. And I came back to work the next day and he said, Deb, we want to offer you a job. We want you to stay with the squad. And in that moment, I said to him, I need to think about it. And I went home that night and I spoke to my boyfriend at the time and my parents. And I just said to them in that moment that if I accept this role, then I can no longer say no to a job. And I can't do that.
How do you look back at that young woman who had the courage and kind of self-knowledge to push back on that?
I don't think I've really thought about that before, Sarah, but I guess now with hindsight, I think it was pretty courageous. It wasn't something that you did. Every time someone said something to you, it was yes, sir, no, sir. And so I suppose it was courageous.
In 1986, Deborah, you were 21. And yep. At that point, working at the district training office next to the Russell Street police station. Tell me about the start of your shift on March 27.
Yeah, March 27, 1986, it was Easter Thursday. I was on a 1 o'clock shift and ordinarily I would walk through what we called the south door entrance of Russell Street. There was a main entrance and then there was the south door entrance. The district training office was the very next office beside the south door. For some unknown reason, normally on a 1 o'clock shift, I'd get in at 1 o'clock and I'd walk through that south door. That particular day, I got in early. I came through the rear car park, which I'd actually never done for the whole time that I had been working there. And I arrived at about 20 to 1 and I sat down at my desk, which was right beside a window. At 1:01, Sarah, there was a bomb blast and I was literally blown off my chair to the other side of the room. And, you know, when people say to you time stands still in those traumatic moments, it truly does. I can still so clearly today visualise everything that happened in that moment. There was a red flash, one window popped, The room filled with smoke. I was blown off my chair to the other side of the room, thrown against the wall, and then every door and window caved in around me. And my first reaction was that I had been shot, because there was nothing else that had ever happened in the history of Victoria to even contemplate that it was a bomb. It just did not enter my head. And I just thought the sheer force of me being thrown across a room had to have been a shotgun or something like that. And so in those frantic seconds, I'm looking down at my body trying to see where the blood is, because I can't think that it's anything else. So I jumped up, you know, you've got adrenaline pumping through your body. I can't find the blood. I'm running out into the corridor, and then all of a sudden my sergeant's there and he goes, "Are you all right?" And I said, "I am." And with that, there was another five explosions that happened from the time of the initial blast. We found out later it was almost like a sound wave concertina effect, where the car's blown up, and then because it's so forceful, other vehicles and things are also blowing up in this kind of sound wave effect.
So there was one car with explosions, but that explosion set off other regular cars.
Exactly, exactly. And so that car was parked right out the front of the south door. What we found out later was that the crooks had tried to get the vehicle into a small car park between the main building of Russell Street and the second building, which housed our D24 communications group. And I had been told, had they have got the car in there, both those buildings would have collapsed. But we didn't always have a guard on duty. We had a guard on duty that day and they said, no, you can't park there. So they parked it out the front of the south door. But I think the realisation was when I was standing in the corridor and all of a sudden we kind of looked at ourselves and gone, oh my God, it's a bomb. And so we start running up and down the corridor trying to evacuate people and then eventually get outside into Mackenzie Street.
What did you see once you made it outside?
About another 200 or 300 coppers standing around, some with blood on them, some with torn shirts, most with a look of horror and shock on our faces, and absolutely having no clue what to do. We just did not know in that moment what to do.
What happened next?
We had the Special Operations Group, who were rightly nicknamed the Sons of God. They were living in a building called the IOOF building opposite Russell Street. And within a matter, I don't know what the time frame was, moments, minutes, I'm not sure, but to see them come down the stairs in formation, in their black overalls, and all of a sudden take control of the scene, I've never been so grateful in all my life. It was like, okay, someone's got control. And all of a sudden they were telling us what to do and where to go.
And what were you directed to do?
So I was asked to block off an intersection, which was a block away from where I'd been. And at that stage had no clue I'd been injured, still had adrenaline pumping through my body. And I'm like, okay, I've got a job. That's what I need to do, is stand here and direct traffic and don't let anyone through.
And so when were you finally seen by a doctor? What injuries had you sustained?
So it was many hours later until I couldn't stand up anymore, and an inspector drove past and he goes, "What the bloody hell are you doing, policewoman?" And I said, "I was their boss." And he goes, "Jesus Christ, like, get in the car. Where do you live?" And I said, "I live in Box Hill." And so he carted me out to Box Hill Hospital, and they didn't know that a bomb had even gone off. I mean, we had no mobile phones or anything like that in those days. And so I was basically put in a wheelchair and told to go home to bed. You've got a back injury.
When you made it back home, did your mum and dad, had they known a bomb had gone off? Were they waiting for you?
Yeah, absolutely. They were waiting for me. Mum, it was funny. My mum thought I was the most innocent little girl, her little innocent princess, even though I was now a policewoman.
And spent some time as a streetwalker at St Kilda.
Yeah, exactly. And she had no clue that I'd smoked in those days. And the first thing I did when I walked up onto the front porch and mum and dad were sitting there was like, "I need a smoke." And it was the first time in mum's life she handed a cigarette over to me and went, "Okay." And we sat there and we had a cigarette together.
The first policewoman to be killed in duty was killed that day, police officer Angela Taylor. What was the motivation of that bomb? I mean, what did the criminal investigation reveal?
So they just wanted to kill as many cops as they could. They had an absolute hatred for police. And in fact, once they left the car on the south door, they went up to Lygon Street, Carlton. Anyone familiar with Melbourne will know that's not so far away from Russell Street. And they watched the bomb blow up. And there were so many stories like mine, Sarah, where people were saved, myself included, that shouldn't be here today. An absolute tragedy for Angela. She was working in the City Watch House across the road beside the courts, and they used to toss a coin at lunchtime to see who would go and pick up the luncheon, and she lost. And she got to the middle of the road where she was standing with another policeman and a magistrate. And the two men decided to wait because cars were coming across. And Angela ran in front of the cars and unfortunately copped the full blast of the bomb.
What was the process of going back to work like for you?
I stayed in bed for 8 days under instructions of my doctor. And on the eighth day, I looked at my parents and I said, if I don't get out of bed today, I'm never going to get out. And I knew in that moment that my career, my life that I had chosen, I was still to be of service. That's what I wanted to do. And in some ways, walking back into Russell Street that day was harder than the day of the bomb because the bomb was unexpected. You didn't know what was going to happen. And I recall parking my car and walking past all these vehicles, you know, with my heart pumping, thinking, is there a bomb in those ones? And I got inside and walked into my office, and it was still trailing with the bomb detectives. And as I got to the door, they looked at me and said, oh, gee, you were lucky, Deb. And I went, yeah, I know I was. And they went, no, you were really lucky. And they said, somebody had put a piece of chipboard against your window, and that's what saved your life.
Despite that, Deb, you continued in the police force. And in 1993... you and your husband, Andrew, who's also a police officer, were approached about fostering a child from Ukraine for a short period. How did that come about?
So, as you said, we were both members of the police force, and there was a legitimate organisation at that stage that had approached Victoria Police to say that they had some children whose parents were first responders on the scene at Chernobyl, the nuclear disaster, and they really wanted to give these children some respite. And, you know, they put the call out and said, will anyone be a foster family member? And so we had agreed, but it took about a year before it came to play, and then all of a sudden there was an urgency about it. I think we got notified around about the August, and it was like, we're bringing them out in September. Will you still have them? And by that stage, I'm then pregnant with our third son, quite heavily pregnant. But I said to my husband, you know, we had agreed to be a foster parent and we still need to go ahead and do that.
What do you remember about meeting little Yuri for the first time?
So we went out to the police academy to meet these children. You know, we were in the cafe of the academy, and there was a bunch of children hanging around, and we were told, oh, this is Yuri, he's yours, he's 11. And in that moment, Sarah, Yuri didn't speak to us. He had a tiny little backpack on his back, which, as we found out later, had, I think, one or two T-shirts, a couple of pairs of underpants. He was wearing a pair of jeans that clearly didn't fit him. They were halfway up his legs. And he looked like this terrified little boy. And, you know, we were like whisking him into our car and come home with us. And he's not saying a word to us. So,
Could he speak any English?
We didn't find out until the four-week mark that he could, and he was sitting down on a Saturday morning watching some cartoons on the TV with my dog beside him, and all of a sudden he laughed and he said something in English, and I happened to be in the kitchen. I looked at him and I went, oh, my God, Yuri, you can talk. But he opened up in that moment, and from that moment on we couldn't stop him from talking.
Well, dogs can go a long way to making a kid feel comfortable. What about your sons? I mean, how did they get on with this new boy in their midst?
So Brody, my eldest, was only five, and Yuri was his idol. He just followed him everywhere around the house. I mean, I look back and think it was quite unfair of Yuri to have a little one tagging along everywhere behind him. But Brody just idolised him. They slept in the same room together. My middle son was only a baby, little toddler at the time. But, yeah, he did everything with Yuri. They'd go out and play on the swings together. He introduced Yuri to Lego and they'd spend many hours building Lego together. It was amazing.
How, Deb, did you realise that things were not as they seemed to be with this charity?
So it was about the third week mark. Originally we were told they were going to have an enormous amount of activities organised and all of a sudden nothing was happening for the children. And so we were getting together with other local foster families to say, we've got to get these kids together. They need to see each other. You know, they've been pulled out from the other side of the world to Australia and know no one. And so we started running our own activities. But on the third week, I started to make phone calls to say, like, what's happening? When are the children going home? What plane are they on? And we received a phone call and we were told that the lady from the legitimate organisation who had set up the original respite for the children had actually left that organisation and she'd stolen all of our records. And then she was associated, I understand, with the Russian mafia. We were told they were Russian businessmen at the time. And we received basically a phone call, an extortionist phone call, demanding that we needed to give them a plane load of medical supplies and $250,000 or they were not going to send the children home to Ukraine.
Oh, my gosh, Deborah.
Yeah.
What did you do?
Well, I'd actually received about day two or three of having Yuri for some reason. I mean, I was in the white pages, but Darren Hinch had got hold of my phone number and rang and said, do you want to do a story? And I was comfortable in doing that, but I said, I need to talk to the organisers. And at that stage, they'd said, oh, no media, which I thought was quite strange. And I guess on the back of having had that call, I thought, actually, there's a story in this. And so I rang the local media and said, you wanted a story. Have I got a story for you? And we did have a media storm around us for the subsequent months that it took for us to get the children home. And it was eventually, we were doing a public meeting out at Dandenong to share the story. Here were all these children. They wanted to go home. They were between the ages of 10 and 16, so tiny little things with us. And they desperately missed their parents, those that had parents. And we told our story and it was actually John Farnham, Sarah, that heard our story and was touched by that, who knew Nikki Lauder, who owned Lauder Air, and they said, we will get you a plane and we will get it straight home to Kiev in Ukraine so it doesn't need to go via Moscow.
Deb, that is an extraordinary story. I can't believe there isn't a feature film made of
yes.
this moment of John Farnham then intervening to get a plane loan. And so in terms of Yuri and the other kids, like were their parents... Their parents must have been frantic as well,
they
not
were.
Knowing when their kids were
they
coming home.
They absolutely were. And most of them didn't have telephones. Certainly Yuri's family didn't have a telephone. We ended up finding a neighbour somewhere that had one and so we would kind of communicate that way. But they were absolutely desperate to have their children home.
So thanks to John Farnham
yes.
and his friend Nikki Lauder,
yes.
the plane comes and you said goodbye to Yuri. What was that like? I mean, how had you seen
him? It was
him?
Heartbreak. Absolutely heartbreaking. He became our son, Sarah, during that time. He was absolutely mine. He put on 5 kilos. All of a sudden he was healthy. He was going home with bag loads of clothes and Lego and all sorts of things. And I think we've got a videotape, would you believe, of the news stories and there's one moment out at the airport where they interviewed me and I'm crying and also heavily pregnant, but crying saying, you know, I don't want him to go home. He's my son now, but I knew he needed to get home to his family.
So thanks partly to your hard work and the work of the other foster parents, Yuri left Australia at the end of 1993 and your third son was born a few months later.
Yes.
Were you able to stay in touch with him or his
no.
family? I mean, this is really pre-internet days, isn't it?
Well and truly. And as I said, they didn't have telephones or anything like that. I wrote several letters over the course of those few months and I eventually received a letter from his mum that I needed to get translated and it was thanking us for everything that we had done for him. We'd sent home things, you know, presents for his mum and his dad as well, who was a policeman. And she was thanking us for all of those, that we treated him like he was our own son. And then we lost complete contact. There was no word after that.
Well, let's jump forward then to 2017. By this stage, you'd left the police force and had worked in different roles while also raising your own three sons. And then one day you stopped to help at a car accident, which sounds like a very Deborah Richardson thing to do, I have to say. What happened?
A car accident happened in front of me. It was around the corner from my home. And so, yes, I stopped to help. You can't avoid that. You can't drive past. And the policeman that turned up on scene happened to be another family foster member. And I hadn't seen him in many, many years. And his first reaction was, "Deb, like, what are you doing here?" And I said, "I've stopped to help." And out of the blue, he says to me, "Have you ever spoken to Yuri?" And I said, "No, I haven't." I said, "Don't tell me you've heard from Sasha," which was his little boy. And he goes, "I have." And I said, "How?" And he goes, "We found him on Facebook." So that night I went home and I was searching for as many Yuri Kachenkos as I could find around the world. And I think I found around about 20-odd and sent out all these messages and hoping frantically, you know, over the course of the next few days that I'd get a message and there was nothing. So I kind of thought, okay, well, that's the end of it for me.
Nothing,
I haven't found
nothing
him.
After all
nothing,
of that.
Nothing. And then 2018, so about a year later, I wake up one morning and here's a Facebook message and it says to me, "Hello, my Australian mummy, Deborah, it's me, it's Yuri." And in that moment, I remember tears springing to my eyes. Then I remember having this sense of, am I getting scammed? You know, he's now a man. Is
always
it really
the police
him?
Officer. Still that cautious voice. How did he prove that it was him?
Well, he ended up saying to me, "I'm at work. When I get home tonight, I will write to you." And he did. And not only did he write to me and tell me he was now a policeman in Kiev, he took a photo of his bedside table where he still had our family portrait sitting there.
So
it was beautiful.
So you'd managed to re-establish contact with one another. But then, of course, just a few years later, Russia invades Ukraine. Were you in touch with him as the war broke out?
Absolutely. The moment the war broke out, I remember very clearly seeing the visions of the tanks surrounding Ukraine, and I was frantically trying to call him, and so there was no answer. And it wasn't until the next day I was driving to work and all of a sudden my phone starts ringing and I pull over and it's Yuri. And we had not spoken on the phone, even though we'd been in contact, we'd emailed, we'd messaged, we'd seen each other on Facebook. And that was probably one of the most heartbreaking phone calls I've ever taken in my life, Sarah. It was like he wanted to tell me his entire life story in that short time that we had. We hadn't heard each other's voice before. And he wanted to tell me everything. He wanted to tell me his mum had died of cancer, probably due to the Chernobyl disaster. And all I wanted to know was that he was safe. And, of course, in some ways he was, but 4 years later he's still not, if that makes sense.
Mm. Did he have a family of his own?
Yes, by that stage he was married and he had a little boy, little Marco, who was only two when we first spoke. And I just recall for 3.5 weeks I wanted to know every single moment of every day that he was okay, and I would be jumping online, looking on my phone, looking for the green dot to know that he's been active now, you know, on Facebook or whatever, and then I'd breathe a sigh of relief, okay, he's okay. But I also cried. I cried a lot because I felt so helpless sitting on the end of the world and not knowing what to do.
So what idea did you come up with?
So my first reaction was I wanted to send him money, and he quickly told me he couldn't accept any because of the corruption laws over there. And we had a call together and I said, "Yuri, I want to do something for the kids. I said, I knit. Can I do something for the children?" And in that moment he said yes. And so I went, okay, not even thinking what it was going to be that I was about to do, but created a pattern, and I ended up calling them, instead of teddy bears, I named them Yuri Bears. And I originally started knitting them myself. I ended up making 1,000 myself personally. And I just launched it initially into my local community and said, anyone want to help? Not even thinking about how I might even logistically get them over there. But very quickly, Sarah, very blessed and lucky to have worked for Ryman Healthcare at the time, aged care and retirement living, 50 villages across Australia and New Zealand. And I went to them and said, I've got this crazy idea. Will you support me? And we had so many people that loved knitting in those villages. And we just had this wave of love and support, and every time I'd walk into a village they go, we've got this many, are we beating the village next to us, and how many have they got? And we ended up making 15,000 Yuri bears.
15,000?
Yeah.
What's a Yuri bear look like?
It's probably about 30 centimetres tall, although depending on who knitted the pattern, sometimes they were smaller or looking like they'd been stretched. So somewhere between that. But 15,000 needed a shipping container to get to Ukraine, and we were very blessed. We found an aid organisation, an amazing man, Tembi Powell, who started a company called Kiwi Care in New Zealand, and he delivers medical aid and decommissioned ambulances actually out of New Zealand and Australia to the front line. And he was looking for toys because so many of the villages had been decimated and the children had nothing. And I said, have I got some toys for you?
But wait a minute, Deb. You didn't end up just putting them in a shipping container and waving it goodbye. You ended up going to Ukraine as well.
I did.
Tell me about that decision.
The more and more that I was just getting this support and the investment of these elderly people that were stitching so much love into each bear, I knew they wanted to see the story out, and I knew they wanted to know what happened. And so as the project was going on, it was 8 months in the making eventually, I started to go, oh my goodness, what if I could be reunited with Yuri? and started to put plans in place, initially not telling my family.
Yeah, I was about to ask, how did your husband view this?
He absolutely didn't want me to go, and when it became obvious that I was going to go, the one stipulation he gave me was, you are not going to Kiev, because Kiev was about 8 or 10 hours into Ukraine from the Polish border. And the initial plan was that I would be reunited with Yuri in a little village on the Polish-Ukraine border where his father-in-law lived that was very safe. And we would reunite there. I'd take across some bears and then I would leave.
What happened?
That was the plan.
What happened in practice?
So Tenby had been delayed. The truck had broken down in Germany. So by the time that Tenby had arrived, I had been reunited with Yuri, the Channel 9 news crew, which was amazing. And then Yuri thought I was staying and I had to leave. And so I went back to Poland for a few days. And then it was about 9 hours to cross the border. It was very convoluted to get across. And so we eventually got across and we're driving a truck, and Tembi says to me, Deb, will you drive the truck? I'm exhausted. And I went, okay, I've never driven a truck before. You'll have to tell me what to do. So I start driving this truck. We pulled up to get petrol and we're chugging down the road a couple of hours into Ukraine, and all of a sudden the truck breaks down again. And we're stuck in the middle of Ukraine. It's getting close to curfew. It's evening. We're on the side of the road. I had no contact with Yuri. Eventually he sent some people to help, and I'm looking at this carload of men thinking, what am I doing? I'm jumping into a car full of strangers, no clue where I'm going, but we're about to get hit by bombs. And they took us to a little village. They were the most incredible people that housed us and fed us and entertained us for the evening, thanked us for being there. And of course the truck was still broken, and so Yuri drove all the way from Kiev to rescue us. And we woke up the next morning on a couple of hours sleep, and he looked at me and he said, Deb, because of all the delays, if I don't take you home today, you're never going to meet my family, and you need to come with me. And I was like, in that moment, there's no doubt I have to go. And so next minute I'm driving down to Kiev.
And what was it like to be with him in person and meet his family?
The most incredible moment of my life. The most incredible moment of my life. My middle son gave me permission to go. He was the one that understood that I had to do this. And he said to a friend when she said, how do you feel about your mum going to Ukraine? And he goes, you know what? I've had my mum for 30 years and I've been so blessed to have her. And he goes, Yuri is as much her son as we are, and if this is her mountain to die on, I'm okay with that. And so I went with my son's permission, with tears rolling down my face when he told me that. But to see Yuri and to meet his family was incredible. I all of a sudden understood what resilience was like and what these poor people had been subjected to for so long. I met his dad, and that was the most wonderful reunion. He stood up and gave a speech on a Saturday evening. We had a family dinner together, and Yuri had to translate, of course, and he basically said he couldn't believe that I was there and that I had looked after his son all those years ago and I was still looking after his son and I'd always be Australian-Ukrainian family. And that was really special, but it was a surreal experience. I lived on adrenaline for the time that I was there, Sarah. And again, your brain doesn't comprehend what you're seeing. One moment you're subjected to devastation. At one stage, we're driving behind a gun truck with this massive, you know, missile gun pointed at us as we're driving down the road. I recall driving past one building that had been bombed and looking up, and you can see in what would have been a window a table and chairs that were set for dinner. And you're looking at these things going, like, are those people even there anymore, or are they not? And so you're walking around and next minute there's a bombed building, there's sandbags. And then the opposite side of that, there's buskers in the street. There's young people dancing in the street, drinking in the bars, living life, and just this vivacity and this, we are not going to let you destroy our lives. And you just, the admiration that I have for the Ukrainian people is huge, and I will never forget it.
That war is still going on. How is Yuri and his family doing?
It's really, really tough, Sarah. His wife's now pregnant. They're due to have another baby in March. And on one hand, I go, that's the greatest gift and gives them hope and joy. And on the other hand, I go, and we're bringing them into this world that they're still subjected to. You know, Marco goes to kindergarten and is often getting evacuated down to a bomb shelter. And this is happening multiple times a day. You know, initially the bombs didn't reach Kiev, and so they were relatively safe. But the drone warfare now makes it accessible and easy, and the indiscriminate bombing is incredible. They are not bombing military places. They are bombing kindergartens and hospitals, and life is tough. Right now it's minus 20 degrees. It's winter time. The Russians have bombed every energy infrastructure that Ukraine has, and so most of the country is in darkness. They don't have heating. They don't have lights. It's heartbreaking. Mm. It is absolutely heartbreaking.
For you, Deb, having made this extraordinary journey, really, that clearly was so important to you and so meaningful to you, how did you feel different about coming back to your own life in Melbourne after this journey?
I absolutely couldn't wait to get home to my family and to hug my kids. But at the same time, it was really tough to leave them, to know that they were still going to be subjected to this and that I didn't have any more control about it. But I came back changed. I was absolutely a changed person, and I knew that whilst I'd had the most incredible career in so many different areas, Sarah, that a year after returning, I knew I needed to get back into something that made a difference. And it was, my next mission was to make sure that I worked in a not-for-profit or a NGO, because I have more to give. And I truly hope that one day war finishes soon and then I can bring out another bunch of another 200 or 300 children, Ukrainian children, that are absolutely going to need some respite and some sunshine. And I hope I can do that one day.
And what role are you in now professionally?
I am now the CEO for Police Veterans Victoria. I've absolutely come full circle and so blessed to be here. We run an incredibly important peer support program, is one of our major support programs, where we match up a veteran with another veteran that needs help and support. And so that is someone that has that lived experience and understands what it was like to serve your community and your state and your country and can relate to that police member that's going through a hard time.
And for you personally, Deb, I mean, through your time in the police force, you obviously had that incredibly traumatic experience of being there on the day of that bombing, as well as all of the other things you would have encountered during your years as an officer. Was visiting Uri and a country at war, I mean, did that shift any of those memories or reframe them in any way for you?
It did, Sarah. Unexpected consequences of going to Ukraine. I really felt like I came home, and I used the word healed. And that's not to say I still don't have a physical reaction if there's a loud noise, but there is a weight that was lifted off my shoulders. I had to do an awful lot of work on my own mental health before I went. I spoke to so many people about what it was going to be like in a live war zone. Nothing can prepare you for it, mind you, until you're there. But I honestly believe that my one experience in life, and yes, it was traumatic, and yes, I've lived with the consequences of that bomb for over 30 years and will continue until the day I die, but I feel like that weight and that heaviness that sat with me has gone. And the reason I believe that is because my one experience was one experience, and yet here is a country and millions of people that are subjected to this day after day after day. And so I'm okay.
Deb, it's extraordinary, the story that you have to tell. Are you still knitting Uri bears?
Well, funnily enough, I ended up needing two joint replacements in a finger because I'd made too many bears. So, but I did come home, and I'd actually had almost 100 koalas that I had knitted, and I have found a charity organisation through one of our veterans in Thailand, and they're going to head over to Thailand to an orphanage over there.
Oh, I so appreciate you sharing some of your really extraordinary story on Conversations. Thank you, Deb.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah. It's a privilege to be here. And I will say, every single person has a story. Every one of our veterans has a story. And those stories are important to share. And so I really appreciate the opportunity.
Deborah Richardson was my guest on Conversations today. And if you're a Facebook user, then take a look at the Conversations page, because Deb has shared some really amazing photos of her and Uri and her trip to Ukraine and, of course, those Uri bears. This conversation was recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples, and it was produced by Jen Leake. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.